copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
The topic I've chosen, how to keep mavericks on your team. And maybe you can tell me, have you had mavericks working with you? Or do you know what I'm talking about? People who don't fit?
Yeah, I work with musicians.
Oh, wow.
None of them.
None of them fit. That's good. Yeah, it depends on the personality and that style. What else? I mean, is this something you've seen? I thought this, that what I'm going to present to you was my invention. So I worked very hard on my notes. And then they said, you need to find references. And I told myself, there are no references for this. So I went on to Google, and I found endless articles on mavericks. Endless. Which is good, I didn't look at them before preparing my notes. I would have felt it's very ununique. But it seems that the problem is common. And the conclusion of most of the articles said, you have to have mavericks to keep an organization alive. And they said Steve Jobs was a maverick at Apple. He just didn't fit in. And yet Apple wouldn't be what it was today if it wasn't for him. So not everybody gets as famous as Steve Jobs. But many bureaucracies exclude mavericks because they don't fit into their staff rules or regulations. And yet often these mavericks are ones who give life and taste to the organization. It takes deliberate discipline and a certain perspective to manage them, to keep them on staff, and to help their colleagues accept them. Now, why are they so important? They think outside the box. And in organizations, as I said, I've been 28 years in the Bible Society, and the most dangerous thing to say to someone is, it's this way because we've always done it this way. And yet people love to say that, and they don't like change. We had a marketing consultant, come in last week, and we brought in some of our bookshop people. And I wasn't in on the session, but the comment came again that one of the bookshop people told the lady, we just don't do it that way. And that's the deadly thing, isn't it? Because he's been doing it. He's been with us 25 years. That's how he does it. And he doesn't want to do it in a different way. He thinks it's wrong. And it's so many things in a church of that way, of course, and in organizations. So it takes deliberate discipline to keep these people on as a manager. And I'm speaking to people in the context of, as a leader, how you nurture, maintain, and make and benefit from and keep mavericks in your organization. So very important because they think outside the box. Therefore, they think creatively, and we all need to be creative. Any mission, any organization that is not renovating itself, renewing itself, is going backwards because the world is changing, and we need to be changing, and most of us don't like change. They also add spark and color, taste to the organization. They're the kind of people who you feel give life when things are getting a bit dull. They push the boundaries. You know, you say, we can't do that. For them, the word can't doesn't exist. Well, let's try it. Let's do this. Let's, you know. And I say, it's impossible. We're going to get in trouble. We'll get arrested. No, let's try, you know. And they look at situations from a different perspective. It's these all different ways of saying, looking thinking out of a box. They believe everything is possible. They don't get daunted by people telling them no. The richest man in Egypt, surprisingly, is a nominal Christian. He claims that God is his main inspiration. We haven't seen much piety in him, but his mother is a believer. Many of you think of Egypt as persecuted Christians. Well, 30% of Egyptian wealth is in Christian hands. And the richest families in the country are Christians. And this man was speaking at the graduation of the American University in Cairo, a very prestigious university. And one of the things he said, one of the reasons I succeeded is I've never accepted people to say it can't be done. I tell them there is a way to do it. And he's a multimillionaire and billionaire. I mean, he's been in a lot of businesses. But I was interested to hear that coming out of him, you know. You don't say no. And so often I sit in committee meetings and things, people say, we can't do this. It can't be done. We don't do it that way. And these people always push the boundaries. These mavericks are usually very persistent. They're hard-headed, they're stubborn, they believe in something, they'll keep pushing. You say no, and they'll go and do it their own way anyway. They're determined to succeed. They're very motivated to succeed, at least my experience. Now, to illustrate it, I'm going to give you some examples, a lot of examples, and then I'm going to tell you how to keep these people in the organization and how to help other people put up with them, because that's the problem. It's their colleagues don't like people who don't come in on time, who don't write reports, who are always trying to get you to do things you're not used to doing. So they irritate bureaucratic type people. And bureaucratic type people like to sit and do everything the way it's been done day to day. I was speaking to someone about this recently who had a secretary who was working, I can't remember who it was, but working in a department, and she'd been doing the same thing for about 30 years. She answers letters and sticks stamps, you know, and puts them on her letters. So he went to her once and he said, "Don't you get bored?" She said, "No. Every letter is different. Every name is different." For her, the variety was that she's writing to different people. But for him, who on earth would want to do the same thing every day? But she found variety in names. Well, there are people like this. And so you tell a person like this to do something else after they've done it for 30 years, they can't think of something else. That's the way to be done. And when we moved into fax and then email, you know that the culture of the world changed when we moved to fax. And I remember I was planning a congress. I worked for the Lausanne Committee for many years. We were planning a very big congress of 4,000 people in Manila. And just as the fax came in, it was 89, and the head of the congress told me, you know, in the previous congress, when I was planning it, letters came, took 2 weeks to come to me, and it would take 2 weeks to go back. So people didn't expect to get an answer before a month. He said, now overnight, people send me a fax in the morning, they're expecting an answer in the afternoon. And he said, I don't know how to do that kind of thing. So we've created since the early 90s a generation of people who are much faster in responding. And those who do not respond quickly are no longer in leadership. You can't be a responsible person if you don't answer an email within a couple of days, or many people have to answer it that day. It's a different culture. It's a different kind of person you've created. So the world is changing, and yet people don't change. My first experience with a maverick was when I was a newly converted student at McGill University in Montreal, and I joined the InterVarsity group, and they introduced me to our new president. And he was a former playboy. He was a wild man who was converted out of a very rotten culture and had decided to go and become an Anglican priest. He thought that's the way to be holy. And he found that the seminary students were living wilder than he was in his wild days. So he was very disillusioned. But he kept the faith. And so we would meet him in the morning sometime, and he'd look very sleepy. "What's up, David?" He said, "Well, I stayed up late at this dance." And we said, "Oh, you went to a dance?" "Yeah, yeah." He said, "I led two of the girls on the dance floor to the Lord." Go to a dance, lead people to the Lord. You know, I came from a church tradition that didn't go to dances, and it didn't seem very orthodox. But these young women kept for years. I know some of them till now, whom he led to the Lord on the dance floor. Now, he was a maverick. And the organization had difficulty because he was the leader. And fortunately, we had a good vice president. But he wasn't the kind of... Mavericks are not good managers or good leaders, but they cast vision. And I learned about unorthodox evangelism from this young man. I'm not going to mention any names now. He, unfortunately, is dead, but all the others are alive. And so I don't want to get myself in trouble. So if someone sees this recording... Last year, I mentioned someone, not by name, but I said enough things about that person that they could be identified. And then I sent her the video. I told her, "This would be good for you to hear." And I forgot that I had used her as an example. And of course, she recognized herself, and I got in trouble. I said, "But I didn't say your name." And she said, "Yes, but, you know, anybody could have figured it out." So I told her, "What did I say about you?" I knew what I said. He said that I'm overextended and exhausted. I said, "Well, isn't that what you are?" She said, "Yes." So I said, "Well, I didn't say anything wrong, but I was saying how too many Christian leaders are overextended and exhausted, so I shouldn't really have used her name." I didn't use her name, but here. So anyway, this young man was the first example I had that my image of what a Christian leader should be and how a leader of a group should be is not necessarily the only one or the right one, and that God can use people who are different than me. And that's the beginning of learning how to accept these people. Because if you think every Christian leader has to be like you, then you have a lot of difficulty accepting mavericks. They give you high blood pressure, and you get allergic to them. My next experience was when I was leading the French student work in Quebec in the early 70s. And they had been what they call a silent revolution in the province of Quebec. The Catholic Church had had, until the 50s, an iron grip on all of the province of Quebec in Canada. So much so that education, medical care, and nearly the government was all under the grip of the church. And then in the late 50s, it cracked. They did what they called the silent revolution, or whatever it was, and they divested the church of all its authority in the community. So the church became powerless. And when the church became powerless in the way it had been used to being powerless, thousands of Catholics left the church. So when we started doing student work, we met students in Canada in the 70s who were completely ignorant of Christian values. They had gone completely the other way. I remember sitting on a bus, and a young student was sitting beside me, and she looked and she said, what's this ring you're wearing? I said, it's a wedding ring. She said, what's that? She had no idea about wedding rings. That's how far they'd gone. And this young man I'm talking about, when we met him, he was living with his girlfriend, and they were just living a normal life in the 70s. And actually, when they came to know the Lord, both of them separated. They didn't have any sex with him. They stayed chaste for 3 years before they got married. Very wonderful testimony. Anyway, he had the gift of evangelism, but he knew nothing about life. He was completely clueless about normal things in life. I once was writing a check in the office because he joined us as staff, and he said, what's that? I said, this is a check. He said, what's a check? I said, a check is something you write for a bank. He had no idea, you know? And you were starting from someone who was below zero. And yet, when he would go on a campus, he would come back and say, 3 kids accept the Lord last week. And he started the group. He would just go and tell them about Jesus. They'd respond. He was a very difficult person to supervise. Very frustrating. But he got results. And I told myself, this young man is not going to succeed in life. He knows nothing about practical. He's living just as this evangelist. All he's going to do is tell people about Jesus. I was worried about him. Today, he's a successful and wealthy businessman in Canada. He drives a fancy car. He's got a nice house. He's got, I think, something like 12 grandchildren. And God has really blessed him. He and his wife are ministry in Haiti. I can't tell you how he got there. I don't know how he got there. Because when I saw him, my prediction was he wouldn't work. But he was such a blessing. So what I'm basically trying to get at is that God began changing me to say there are people who are useful and valuable if you can only bring them in and protect them. Because these people are very sensitive. They're very sensitive to criticism. And you can crush them easily. So you have to handle them, I don't know if you know that expression, with kid gloves. You have to handle, and I had to learn by my mistakes. I often hurt his feelings. I often was frustrated by him. But now as I look back, I think I did the right thing. To provide a safe place for a maverick to do his own thing. To protect him from the world so that he can really thrive. When I joined the Bible Society of Egypt, we were beginning to... It had been an organization that had been going on for 100 years. We had 3 very dingy bookshops and about 15 staff. And the board, where the average age of our board was 80 years. So I was in my 40s and my board chairman was twice my age. So it was a bit intimidating. And I started hiring staff, and I didn't think of the fact that I was hiring mavericks, but it turned out nearly everybody I had in those early days were mavericks. They just didn't fit. And of course, the older staff found them very hard to put up with. So one day, we hired a man to do the sales, and he was a gifted salesman. Really, he had the sense. He could smell things, if you understand to say. We bought some shops or set up. He would know where you have to have a shop on what street corner, which shop would make money, which shop would lose. He had that sense, you know, that business sense. He was also very smart in terms of knowing when things went wrong. We had many accountants in the Bible Society, more higher number than we needed. And he came to me one day very early. I said, go down to our... We had a theft in one of our bookshops, and we fired the manager. So I sent him down I'll start before that. I sent him down to learn about how we do sales. I said, spend a couple of days in our bookshop. So he went to the bookshop, and there were about five people working there. He came back to me in about 2 hours. He said, they're robbing you. I said, robbing me? Well, how are they robbing me? He tried to explain it to me. In those days, I didn't understand much about accounts. So I said, sit with the accountant. Explain to the accountant how these people are robbing. In the meantime, I went to the guy who was my vice director. He was an older man than me. He'd been there for 30 years. And I said, could this bookshop manager be a thief? He told me, absolutely not. He's a pastor's son. He's been with us 29 years. Whoever says he's a thief is crazy. This young man you hired, just been here for 3 days and goes down, spends 2 hours and tells you he's a thief? Crazy. We had an internal auditor and we had an accountant. And the internal auditor used to always tell me, I review everything, all the books are right, everything. But you know, accountants, all they do is look at paper. They don't smell these things. So half an hour with the accountant and my newly appointed Maverick staff convinced the accountant that the bookshop manager was a thief. How did he do it? He said, we give 25% discount to bookshops, so he makes up a bill in the name of a bookshop for books he has sold at retail. So he puts a 25% in his pocket. So my accountant phoned the bookshop and said, we were very happy we were able to serve you 2 months ago. Are you happy with the books we sent to you? The bookshop said, we haven't bought books from you for a year. And the bill said 2 months ago. He did this with several things, found that there'd been major theft over the last few years from the bookshop people. It was a very difficult situation. But you see, that maverick, that guy who didn't fit in, could smell and sense and feel things that the very experienced internal auditor who checked all the books, it never occurred to him. It never occurred to him that invoice he was approving was a fake invoice. And Egypt is that way. I mean, one of the reasons, of course, this man was helpful is he lived outside of a Christian bubble. I once was hiring an accountant, and I said, what did you do in the previous job? And he said, I cooked up the books. I said, what do you mean you cook the books? He said, well, all Egyptian companies, they do their own accounts, and then end of the year, to present it to the government, we redo all their accounts with fake bills and things. So I have a whole stack of letterheads and invoices and bills that have fake companies in, and we just fill them in, and we give them reports showing that they lost rather than gained. That's my job. I said, well, thank you. I decided I didn't want to hire him. He was trying to show me how I could save money by hiring him. But this was the kind of world we live in. But this man who joined us had come from that kind of world, and he knew, and he could feel, and he could sense. One day, him and another guy who was a maverick was with us, and we went to visit a man who owned the building, and we were thinking of buying 2 floors of that building. So I had made the mistake of taking these 2 men with me. And we sat with this man and were negotiating about buying the 2 floors. And suddenly, one of them, I can't remember who, told this man, he said, how much would you sell us the whole building for? Now, of course, I had never occurred to me in a million years to buy the whole building. And it wasn't my idea. But those guys got their minds together and decided they wanted to buy the whole building. So the man who was selling it to me, was selling these 2 floors, said, I can't sell you a building. There are 5 apartments here have been sold, the others are rented, and the only space available is the one that's available for sale. They said, that's no problem for us. We don't want, we just want to know how much you want to sell the whole thing. And he said, well, what would you do? He said, don't worry about it, we'll manage. We ended up buying the building, and these 2 men convinced all the people who had bought apartments in that building to sell us their apartments. And the way they did it was, I mean, it was a very dangerous thing to do, because if anyone had said no, we'd have been stuck with a Muslim tenant, for instance, something in a Bible Society building. But they negotiated, of course, a very good price with a man, because he thought they could not do it. He was convinced that there's no way you could get rid of these people, and so he sold it to us very cheap, not very much more than it would have been to buy the 2 floors. And secondly, when they began negotiating for each floor and each person, they would find a man in a 2-bedroom apartment. They'd say, well, come with us. And they take him to a lovely apartment next door, not too far away. It's a free bedroom. We will buy you this apartment if you will move from Yopa. You can buy me a free bedroom apartment if I move? Yes, we will. Okay, dum tum tum, they did it. One guy didn't want to sign, so they got the money. You will pay in cash in Egypt. So they went to bank and said, we want the smallest denomination. It was £5 bills. And they got two of our janitors carrying these big boxes full of cash. And they walked in with these big, enormous boxes. He said, here's the money. You just sign here and you get these boxes. The guy opens, saw all the cash. And just a mass of cash for a simple person was very convincing. And. But you see, they operate. If I had told my accountant, you say, write him a check. You know, that's what the accountant would have done. But these guys had the sense to know that when you make a deal, you do it a bit differently. You know, and we bought all the people out. Within a year, we bought everybody out, and the price we paid wasn't exorbitant. And we're now in a lovely Bible house in Cairo, six floor building. It's a phenomenal place, thanks to these two guys who did things differently than I would ever have done them, and did things I didn't even dream of doing. I mean, I am known in the Bible side having vision and dreams. I never had a vision for such a big building, this kind of thing. They had it. So I benefited from these people, from that vision. Another man came along and said, I'm willing to help you do fundraising. Now, when I joined the Bible Society, they said, you know, it's very hard to do fundraising. We Egyptians don't give money to charities. They give it only to their churches. We don't have a license to do fundraise, a legal license to fundraise. Etc., etc., etc. We used to visit a few churches. We used to raise the equivalent of $10,000 from these churches over a whole year, you know. So that's all we did, and they figured you can raise it 10%, 20%. This man came along and said, no, I think we can do better. He said, we'll get fundraisers who will go to people in their homes and take a monthly donation. So we'll get people to make pledges and send the person. There's no checks, there's no mail, that's reliable. So he said, no problem. We'll send the person to go and visit you and say, would you please give to the Bible Society and tell you about the Bible Society? And you say, okay, I'm going to give 10 pounds, Egyptian pounds a month, 20 Egyptian pounds a month. He said, okay, I'll come every month and collect it. So you can't say no if someone's going to come to your house and collect the amount. And he built up a team of fundraisers that went to churches, and we began with the Oak. Our majority church is the Coptic Orthodox Church. They began, they were resistant. So this man, one day when we were visiting the patriarch of a church, an elderly man who didn't have much love lost for evangelicals, but liked love the Bible. In the middle of a meeting, he said, Your Holiness, would you sign us a pledge that you will give us money every month to the Bible Society? He was taken a bit aback, but he said, okay. So this guy pulled out a fancy form he'd made, had the patriarch sign it, and of course, once the patriarch signed that he was going to give us £100 a month, that piece of paper was used by all our fundraisers with photocopies, say, the patriarch gives, aren't you going to give? So you go to a businessman and say, your patriarch gives money to a Bible Society, why don't you give? So it was a tacit endorsement by the head of a Coptic church to give money to a Bible Society. And if I told him to make an announcement to do that, he wouldn't have done it at that time. But that was a tacit thing. Just to give you an example of that. In 1990, we were raising, I said, $10,000. 2016, and we were visiting about 10 churches. 2016, we visited 800 churches and were raising $1 million from Egyptians. With 45 full-time fundraisers. Because I had a maverick who thought that the impossibility could be done. You know, so I'm talking about these people. But managing these people, I'm telling you the good side, managing these people was a nightmare. And many times I felt, you know, because these are the good things. They did some things that weren't as good. But you can't expect a person to always do what you want or always succeed. They risk, and sometimes the risk doesn't work. But if you're not going to risk in life, you're not going to succeed. And I learned through these people to sail. We had, let me see, I put them all in initials, so I have to remember who the initials are. I can't remember. Oh, yeah. Once in my great wisdom, I appointed a very reliable person who used to be one of our editors to be the head of our publishing department. Our publishing was growing. We are a publishing house. He was a very smart man, a church leader, a thinker, and I said, why don't you head it up? He liked the idea. Moved him from a town in the south to come to Cairo, paid for the move. He became the head, very prestigious man. 6 months later, this man was having a heart attack. He didn't know how to manage. He was a thinker, he was a teacher, he was very good, but I had not, to me, I hadn't realized that there are some people who can't manage. So when you would discuss something with him, so he'd get very nervous, very upset. When you disagreed with something, and you know, salespeople want a book to come out on time, and this book is late, so the salespeople, he'd get very nervous. So it became obvious that he was not in the best place. So, by God's grace, and this doesn't happen very often, she changed positions with the editor. So the editor became the manager and he became the editor. And that was just God's grace. From that position as editor, he's now one of the most well-known Egyptian speakers. He's got television programs. He travels all over for Bible Study. He just came back from a trip in the States last month. He loves doing what he's doing, and he's doing it very differently. But he's not the kind of person you keep to a schedule. You can't keep him very organized. He just wasn't the right person to be the manager. But he was a perfect person to represent us, to raise money for us, to speak on our behalf, to do radio programs, and these kind of things. So it's sometimes you think of putting someone in there, and then it doesn't work. God, by God's grace, we didn't have to fire him. We were able to reassign him, and God used him in a great way. Same thing happened with another man. He was one of our salesperson manager for the south of Egypt. He had 5 staff under him, and they were all complaining because they felt he had favorites. They just didn't like him as a manager. And I was really, I liked the man, and I felt sorry, and I didn't know what to do. And suddenly I got the idea that we'd make him a public relations person. So I said, such and such, why don't you become the public relations person? You will make the Bible Society known. He said, what's that? I said, it's just you go to people and you tell about us, you deal with church leaders, government, and so on. This man today is one of the best known Christians in the country. Businessmen call him for him to make deals between them. He's just incredible. I don't go to these events. So for instance, the patriarch of the church was coming back from a medical trip. He was sick. So all of Egyptian important Christians were going to meet him at the airport. I don't do that. So I told this young man, you go on my behalf. So he said, he went there, he said, there were dozens of bishops, the place was very crowded, and all of a sudden I found myself in front of a patriarch. Well, I mean, you don't all of a sudden find yourself in front of a patriarch. He must have wangled his way through. But when I go to him, I went the other day, we had a big event at the cathedral, and I went with him, and told him, you have to have permissions, we had to phone, there's a lot of security now. So we had to have all sorts of paperwork, the license of a car. So I sat in the back seat, 2 of my staff were in the front seat, he was in the passenger seat, another leader was in the front seat. And we came to the door of a cathedral, big cathedral downtown. They were asking people things. They saw him. Oh, Mr. Sedge, yes, come in, sir. He's known. He's persona grata. I mean, he's very much appreciated in the place. Nobody knows me, but they know him. And he once got the idea. He said, why don't we invite the ambassadors from Christian countries to come and celebrate with us? We're celebrating ambassadors from Christian countries. What's this all about? You know, I never thought of him. He had this big event. We had about 20 ambassadors came, and it was a very successful event. Once I was at a book fair, and again, some important person was speaking, and it was a very crowded room. And I went with him, and he always goes late. He never goes on time. And I get very frustrated going with him places, but I know he's going to get me in. So there was no place in the whole room, packed. And he wanted me to sit in the front, no place. So he told me, you stay here, keep your cell phone, I'll get you a seat in the front. How is he going to get a seat in the front? A few minutes later, the first cell phone rings. Come to the front row. Front row. So I walk very embarrassed all the way to the front row. He had gone into the manager's office, took his chair from behind the desk, pulled it to the front, sat on it, and he was sitting there in the front row on the chair of the manager of the place. Well, the manager was sitting, of course, with the other people, so he didn't know his chair was being taken. And he had me sit on the chair in the front row. You know, who could do that? So here I ended up being in this important meeting in the front row. See, he never wants to go on time because he always can do these things. When I go, I'm always embarrassed. We went to another meeting just a few days ago. He went up and met the people. I'm not that kind of person. He just met all the government officials. When I came, they said, "Sir, your Bible site, you sit here." And he was beside me. He just kept walking. He wouldn't sit here. He doesn't accept no for an answer. And people, you know, when you see someone very confident, you don't stop him. So he goes there. When Pope Francis was coming to Egypt, this friend of mine is a Catholic, and he's an evangelical Catholic, and he told me, "We have to have something for the Pope. We have to do a special event." So we printed a special booklet, which was printed 30,000 of them. He said, "I'm going to have a committee meet at the Bible site." Yeah? He said, "The committee planning the Pope's visit is going to meet at the Bible site." So the committee planning the big event with Pope Francis met at the Bible site. He became the interface between that committee and the Egyptian government. So he would take them to meet the prime minister, to meet the president, to do a thing. He was going back and forth with security. He became, that's the kind of person he is. I scared stiff to do that kind of thing. I don't know how to relate to these people. And this is a man who failed being a sales manager in the South. And he's now one of the most successful people. But he's very hard to supervise. He does crazy things still and drives me bananas. But he can do things that none of us can do, and he's made the Bible site known all over Egypt in all sorts of places simply because of his movement. Very naturally, he walks in there, and you think, whenever I'm behind him, I'm very secure because I know I'm going to get to where I want to go. So why is it difficult to keep these people? It's difficult because they don't come on time. It's not really that important if they don't come on time to the office in terms of their work. But it's very annoying to the other staff who, if they come late, are going to get deducted for their pay. And these guys don't get deducted from pay. If we did that, they'd quit. So we have to treat them differently. Now, to convince 200 staff that you're going to treat 5 staff differently is nearly impossible. It's very difficult. But what we would lose if we insisted that these guys come on time, I mean, I did it with one man. One of these guys, I got very frustrated. I said, "You have to come on time." He quit. He really quit. He said, "I can't get up in the morning." It's like the artists, you know. In Egypt, actors and artists, you know, they wake up at 2 in the afternoon and they go to bed at 4 in the morning. We actually have a bookshop in a place in Alexandria in the summer. Its hours are from 2 in the afternoon till 4 in the morning because that's when the people are out on the street. If we had 9 to 5 like we usually do, we wouldn't get any customers. So with our mavericks, we have to deal with them that way. And I have to take the flak. Why is this man not coming on time? Why do you force me to come on time? And you solely have to try to explain. Yes, but he has a special kind of job. He has a special kind of position. And it is not easy. It is not easy. And we don't always succeed. And then when people see them, everyone wants to be like them. I want to be like this person who doesn't come on time or who doesn't have to write reports or doesn't have to do things. So very difficult to keep office hours. They often come late to meetings. As I said, I told this man, if you don't come to meetings on time, you can't come anymore, and he quit. You know, fine. It was difficult because he was one of our managers and needed to come on time. But that's the way these people think. They just can't fit, you know. And so you have to decide, do I lose him or do I adapt to him or her? And it's a very difficult decision to make. They often also are very distracted by their own personal agendas. You know, there are two kinds of staff I find deal with. Staff who respect the institution, who know there are rules, we're working for institution, and staff who think they're working for God and for themselves. And you can't tell me what to do. I'm working for God. Very difficult to handle these people. So some, you can say, okay, go and work for God and bye-bye. But other people, you say, we would lose a lot if we lost him. And all these decisions I'm talking to you about, I do with my senior staff. It's not just myself. We sit 3 or 4 of us, and we discuss, what shall we do with this very difficult person? And we make these exceptions as a group. So it's not just a personal thing, because I have to have my senior leadership with me on this. But in general, it's difficult. The other thing is they're distracted by personal matters. One man who has was doing Pope Francis has now a problem with his back, and all he talks about is problem with his back, and he's very depressed, and he's very engrossed in his own situation. I have other staff who have back pain. They'll tell me about it. But they'll tell me about it once, and then they don't talk about it. They may put a special pillow behind, they may go and get physiotherapy, they may be in pain, but they're not continually obsessed with themselves. These people tend to be always obsessed with their own situation. They have a crisis at home, my son failed an exam, or they get very depressed. This happens. The other staff's son also failed the exam, they don't get depressed, or they don't tell me about it. Do you understand the difference? So for some, they bring in the home into the work, and it's very annoying. And I'm generalizing because the five or six people I have like this are that way. So it's not a coincidence, you know. And you have to sort of be very interested, very kind, but put your limits. When you put your limits, you just put them gently. You don't put them angrily. You don't put them impatiently. And you say, we really need you to come on time to the staff meeting because it's encouraging for the staff to see you. Shall I send someone to get you? You know, that kind of thing. You work on it. And slowly it gets a bit better. They also, unfortunately, often overspend their budgets. Tell them you have $200 for this, and he put you in a bill for $2,000. And it's done, you know. Other people don't think that way, you know. Other people think, if it's $200, it's $200, I'm going to spend $199. But if it's $200 and they think they have to spend $2,000, they'll end up spending $2,000. And they can't be easily asked to do things they don't like to do. You know, I can go to another staff member and say, could you please do this? You know, I know it's not your job description, but we need you to do this. These people find it very hard to do something that they don't like to do. It's a situation. So they don't like to write reports. And that kind of thing. Now, the main job I have in my organization with these people is to sell them to the organization. I have to talk a lot about them, to praise them a lot to the other staff, to explain to the other staff the great achievements of these people, to see how we all benefit from what these people do. And in general, it works. So when Pope Francis came and the Bible Society had a big role in his visit, this was the first time a Christian leader in the world was welcomed by the president of Egypt. It's never happened before. And there was a lot, and Christians are a minority, a discriminated minority in Egypt. So for someone like Pope Francis to have good press, regardless of what you think of Pope Francis and the Catholic Church, for us as Christians in Egypt was very important. He wanted to do his last meeting in a very large place. The army gave him an army stadium. So they had their mass in an army stadium. This is, in a Muslim country, this is unheard of. This is a secular stadium. You don't go and do a religious meeting. You know, our country doesn't allow that. Well, they allowed it. So a lot of exceptions done. So when the staff saw that a lot of this was done by this man, they were proud. So you have to keep saying that. And you have to keep saying how valuable these people are to the staff. That's the first thing to do. The other thing is they tend to work more for the leader than for the organization. I put a lot of effort into them, so you get the impression they're working for me more than for Bible Society. And you have to be very careful. Very careful of this. That's the other problem. And finally, it's very hard to know when to put your foot down. Where sometimes you have to, like I told you, a man who didn't come on time, I had to put my foot down. So it doesn't mean everything works. You have to come to a point where you say enough is enough. And you have to calculate the risk, and you have to know what you do, because you can't just do it. And then, and I haven't had to face it till now, but there may come a point where you have to fire a person. I have another seminar on firing people. But there are I have funny topics.
They weren't funny then.
No, they're not funny. They're very difficult. It's the saddest thing I've had to do. I fired about 25 people in 28 years. So it's very, very difficult. Very difficult. And they're often some of the ones you think are most promising. And they end up doing bad things, you know. So it's very hard. I haven't found any dishonest mavericks, but I found mavericks who are very hard to keep within what you may call an acceptable eccentricity. They're eccentric, okay, but you have to keep it within, and usually it works. Usually it works, but it doesn't all. The big challenge now, I'm reaching retirement age at the Bible Society, the big problem I have is when someone takes over leadership now, I have to make a very good sales pitch to the person who's taking over from me about these mavericks. Because if someone comes in without knowing the background, to supervise them, they will not last very long. So you have to make that when mavericks are in organizations, you have to make sure that in transitions, they don't get just kicked out. Because someone coming in says, everybody has to do this. Everybody has to do this. You know, one of our big problems in organizations in general is the everybody has to do it is true, but you can sometimes lose your best people. And we have a crisis now in the Bible Society, so I'll end with a sad note, where we have two of our staff, and one of them is real maverick, the other one is half a maverick, and they have been reassigned to a different department, and they are very depressed, and they're very crushed. And when they're both fundraisers, and when a fundraiser is depressed and crushed, they're useless to you. Because how can they talk excitingly about the big work of a Bible Society depressed? And their supervisors say, but that's the way it is, we have to do it. So I'm now fighting with their supervisors. Can't you accommodate them? I accommodate, they're spoiled people. And, you know, and I'm watching it now, and it's very difficult, very delicate. But if we do it to them, will we do it to a 45-hour funder? I say, but aren't they exceptional? Yes, that person is exceptional. There's no one like them. They're doing phenomenal work. They raise a lot of money. You know, we have events for children. And one of these fundraisers went to a businessman who is a Christian by name, doesn't know anything about really the faith. But she was able to really convince the man to give us very valuable gifts for the kids who would succeed in the Bible competition. Well, what kind of gift do we give to someone who succeeds in the Bible competition in the South? You'd be surprised. We give them washing machines, fans, guitars. So very fancy gifts. And this woman gets truckloads of these things to be donated to the Bible Society. And the people want to really memorize the Bible quickly so they get their prize. It's been very energetic. I'm talking about thousands. We have about 100 churches involved in each event. The churches send their four best people who compete together on the stage between them. And then we give away maybe 300 prizes for those who win. So able to get these gifts from this businessman. You know, nobody's able to do this. But she's a depressed staff member today because we're not able to work exactly who she should work under and how she should work. Very hard to handle. So I'm sharing this with you because it burdens me. Because we can't afford to lose her, but we don't know how to have her fit in the right place. You can't have someone without a boss. She doesn't fit well under the boss she's under. And he's a bad man. He just isn't the kind of person who's going to give her the vision. So my story with Mavericks is my success at the Bible Society, the success over years, has been due to Mavericks in many ways. You know, great success of our organization. It's been due to these people, but they're the hardest people to keep. And my greatest energy expenditure is to help keep them happy and to keep the supervisors happy and to keep the other people a bit not sort of criticizing or complaining to them. That's all I have to say. Maybe we can have some time to discuss and to... Thank you. Thank you for coming after lunch. This is very... Yes.